This is, I can't say this will be a seminar in statistics, so you all should be safe. My name is Josh Mizell. I'm one of the co-directors for the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. As of today, January 29th, I have not heard from Jimmy Kimmel. I don't know if anybody else has. I seem to be asked that every day. I don't expect to, but you know, if I do, I'm sure you'll hear about it. For those of you that are not familiar with the Institute, our mission is to design and conduct and disseminate research, provide applied expertise to policymakers, researchers, health professionals, businesses, and the media, and archive and provide access to source materials. Our goal is to improve the economic, social, physical, and environmental health of individuals and communities through the interdisciplinary scientific study of marijuana. And it's great to see so many different folks here, and we all look forward to what should be a fascinating presentation. I'm going to introduce the speaker in a moment, but I did want to just draw your attention to some other talks in the speaker series. I had put out a complete listing of the different talks. I see folks have picked that up, but I'll just give you a heads up. First of all, anything I say, in case you don't remember it, you can just visit our website, humboldt.edu/HIIMR. That's the acronym for our institute. The next talk will be on February 26th, again a Tuesday evening at 5:30 in the same space. The title of that talk is The Potential Economic Impact to Humboldt County if Marijuana is Legalized. That'll be given by Jennifer Budwig as with Redwood Capital Bank, but that was some research she did, I believe on it was on her MBA. Following that in March, I'm pretty excited about this. This is my old advisor from when I was an undergraduate down at UC Santa Cruz. Craig Reinerman will be giving a talk on developments in Dutch drug policy. Is the Netherlands moving toward U.S.-style cannabis prohibition? And that's on a Monday. Note that it's not a Tuesday, Monday, March 25th. And then our last speaker in our first annual speaker series will be on April 30th. Amanda Ryman, who's with the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley, as well as a policy manager for California, the Drug Policy Alliance, will be speaking on dispensary-based research and untapped source. So if you're interested in more information about the speaker series and specific talks, please take a look at our website. I also want to give you a heads up about a conference or mini-conference that my colleague Tony Salvaggio is working on organizing that will be scheduled for April 19th and 20th. Yes, that's intentional. New Frontiers in Marijuana Research and Policy in the United States. The description that he provides for the talk or for the conference is it's going to be an annual gathering uniting scientists, policymakers, community organizations, activists, students, and community members to share their expertise and insights around marijuana issues. The plan is for a keynote addresses, workshops, films, and over 20 panels. He's working on getting a website up. It will be linked off our Institute page, and the public, different folks are welcome to submit session ideas. So take a look at that. And that may be of interest. Finally, I'm going to be leading a weekend workshop entitled The Emerald Triangle. That's on April 13th, so the weekend before Tony Salvaggio's event. If you're interested in this workshop, there's information about the workshop as well as registering for it up on the table up here. So I'd like to introduce our speaker. You've all been so patient
hearing my... I seem to have lost what I had here.
So I will just say that I'm going to have to make this up. No,
that's
I won't
fine.
Make it up.
Make it up.
Monica Stevens comes all the way down from Founders Hall. She's in the Department of Geography. And Monica is she's published in a variety of different places, including Salon.
Salon.com, Wired, CNN.
Wired.
So, Guardian.
Very much a public geographer insofar as she has a strong interest in sharing the work that she does with the general public, and I think that's very important and valuable and much appreciated. A little bit of information you might not have known about Monica. She recently participated in the TED Talk Eureka. And Monica also blogs on floatingsheet.org on geography-related issues. So we're thrilled to have her all the way here from Founders Hall. So without further ado, Monica Stevens.
Thank you. And thank you, Josh, for that lovely introduction. And thank you to all of the other members of HIMR, the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research, for having me here today. And thank you to the community here at Humboldt State for also having me here in the broader sense as well. I'm really glad to be up here and studying your community and living here and working with you all. So today I want to talk about a paper that I've written with two colleagues, my colleague Matthew Zook at the University of Kentucky and Mark Graham at the University of Oxford in England. We've titled this paper, Data Shadows the Underground Economy, and it's been accepted to Economic Geography with minor revisions. So it should be coming out sometime in 2013. So the paper that I'm going to talk about today analyzes the retail geography of one particular underground economy, one particular economy that affects us quite deeply here in Humboldt County. And the way that I'm going to study this and the way I'm going to present it is I'm going to talk about marijuana in terms of this new and unique database of anonymous user-submitted content regarding reports on the purchase price and how much people spent to buy marijuana. So this analysis demonstrates both that the marijuana economy conforms to very standard economic practices and economic theory in terms of supply and transportation effects, as well as conforming to state-level regimes about the legalization and the negative impacts, as well as the significant impacts on price. So in contrast, these rates of arrest, possession, and sales actually do not produce statistically significant effects on the price of marijuana. Rather, these demands have a very weird and interesting demand-side effects that are much more complex to interpret. So although these findings are kind of unsurprising for the most effect, they demonstrate the effectiveness of combining volunteered geographic information with studies of economic practices that would otherwise be impossible to conduct. So the way that I'm going to talk about this today is I'm going to talk about this economic geography of the underground informal economies, and then I'm going to follow that by talking about the spatialities of illegal drug economies, followed by the analysis that I conducted with my colleagues of 1,600 retail purchases of marijuana, and I'll present my statistical results of that. So, well, underground and informal economies are really difficult to measure. It's really difficult to define the size or really the estimates of even how much of our economy is represented through the underground economy ranges from 12%, and usually that's in very developed economies like Denmark, to up to 39% of the gross domestic product in less developed countries. So we really can't totally measure and quantify this. We know that it has huge effects on how the economy works. So alternate economic spaces and informal work really allow for a lot more in our economy that we don't mind and that's part of our everyday life, like gifting economies, generosity, and a range of practices that are very socially accepted, but really do remain uncommodified and uncommodifiable and really outside of the formal networks of trade. And so this includes people sharing with each other, people giving stuff to each other, people working together and collaborating and really transacting in ways outside of the framework. So think about all the things that you do that you don't get paid for. But also examples include a lot of the darker sides of the economy, like child labor, prostitution, and forced human trafficking. They really can consist precisely because they are hidden in our economy and there's no regulation or even quantifying of those. So there are also really multiple problems with studying any sort of underground economy. As you can imagine, there's a need for a lot of really ambitious, time-consuming work with a very expensive data collection with subjects who might not be very willing to disclose a lot of information to researchers. It's really difficult methods of data collection, surveys, interviews, that sort of thing. And it really limits what studies have been done and what studies can be done about these types of economies. So there's a lot of challenges with cross-checking the reports from these different informants that you might have, and also with human subjects issues of talking to people who are really embedded in these illegal and illicit practices as well. So furthermore, the context of underground economies frequently mean that only certain kinds of data can possibly be collected, and these data generally are very, very limited in the scope. There's very few respondents, and they're very focused on very small areas, small regions, and small numbers of people. And you can't really get an extensive scope that covers and illuminates these general practices that are occurring within society. So, in this talk, I'll argue about the utilization of novel forms of data collection to analyze these very traditionally unmeasured scales of these economies. So the phenomenon of volunteer geographic information, in which ordinary citizens, like any one of you in this room, me, anybody at all, can make reports about local conditions, like the price of marijuana, like the weather, like your experience in an earthquake. And that we can then, as researchers, aggregate this information and get a larger idea of what that means as a practice and what that means across space. And so we call this volunteer geographic information. So as much as this has a lot of means for potential and potential for data collection, there's a lot of problems associated with it as well, as far as if you're thinking about the potential privacy considerations of these underground economies, and that the people who are creating it sometimes are not aware of how the data they create will be reappropriated and used by researchers to study something different than how they intended, or perhaps reappropriated by government sources or other options in places they might not like to see the information they provided appear. So, well, there's no single answer on how to balance the potential of volunteer geographic information, or VGI, as I like to call it. The case of the underground economy presented here really explores the issues of sale and the distribution of marijuana, and it does provide a means to understand how these areas really intersect as a way to get an idea of what the economy of marijuana looks like. So researching the marijuana economy, as you can imagine, is a pretty interesting process. The United Nations World Drug Report estimated that the global market for marijuana is equivalent to about $100 billion. That's a huge amount of money. And that was in 2005. They estimated that about 4% of the global population use marijuana annually. Over 10% of North Americans have smoked marijuana within their lifetime. And the United States is both a major producer and consumer of marijuana, and in fact, believe it or not, I'm sure many of you do recognize that it's our largest cash crop in the United States as well. So it's a very important source of income for some rural regions, especially this part of Northern California, as well as Appalachia, which is like Kentucky and West Virginia, as you didn't know. But research on the more macro level issues of the organization and production of the retail pricing is hampered by the same data issues that substantially hinder research in other informal economies, such as the lack of consistent and reliable data about marijuana. So the informal and illegal nature of the economy makes obtaining legal market data a very challenging project. So there are several different resources that have tried to aggregate it, but most of these resources are on the end of the government, and people are not as willing to provide accurate resources about their marijuana use to the government. So the Price and Purity of Illicit Drugs report that was prepared for the U.S. Office of National Drug Control provides national-level figures claiming that the retail price of marijuana is about $16 per gram in 2007, and that's about $450 an ounce. But they don't have any indication of geographic difference within their pricing scheme for marijuana, assuming it's just one monolithic thing that costs the same price in every location in the United States. So this can also, these problems with it can also be attributed to issues as to how it's obtained. So the system to retrieve information from drug evidence, which is called STRIDE, that database is used by a study. It contains only 5,634 records between 1981 and 2007 indicating the price. So as much as over 5,000 records seems like a large amount, in more than 25 years, that's not very many reports as to how much marijuana costs, and you might think that it might have changed price over that time. So aggregating one price based on that large range of time over a large range of geography and assuming it's one price leads to some methodological issues with making this assumption. So official statistics on price tend to be extremely vague, both monetarily and geographic. And this is not just a United States issue. This is also true in Europe, where the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction in 2008 used extensive surveys, but they came up with very similar results that prices of both herbal cannabis and resin varied from 2 euros to 14 euros per gram, with a majority of European countries producing reporting prices between 4 euros and 10 euros for both products. So this is just saying marijuana costs the equivalent of $75 to $534 per ounce. That's a huge range that tells us very little about marijuana and how the marijuana economy functions over space. This is over all of Europe, which is a huge area as well, with massive differences in class and all sorts of issues with legal structures as well. So this tells us almost nothing about what is the subnational variations in the price of marijuana in the United States and what factors can potentially explain this variation in the United States. So we still don't understand much. And again, these are all government sources that people are not likely to or that are to report to and that are getting information more from the people who are arrested and from that end of things than what's happening at the regular scale as far as what's happening in the marijuana when people are not being arrested. So as far as using VGI to study marijuana and using VGI to study a lot of these things, there's three products that have been highly visible and transformative in this process. And these are Wikipedia. Who here has used Wikipedia? Most of you. So Wikipedia is the online encyclopedia that claims to be the sum of the world's knowledge, and people provide massive amounts of information to that. The next one's OpenStreetMap. Who here has used OpenStreetMap? Two, and they're both my students. So OpenStreetMap is the Wikipedia of maps, where anybody can contribute spatial information about whatever is going on, their community. They can trace out these things. And the third one is Ushahidi. Has anyone heard of Ushahidi or used it? No. So Ushahidi is a Kenyan-based mapping platform. It actually means witness in Swahili, and it was created around ordinary users mapping election violence. So when you go to the polls and you see somebody clubbing somebody, you can actually submit an SMS-based message, which is just a text message, to a central database, and it puts that point on the map indicating where violence has occurred. So it became really important as far as mapping Haiti after the Haitian earthquake and looking at all sorts of different places where election violence has been a potential issue. So these platforms have really transformed who can conceive and who can contribute volunteer geographic information. And in the same way that somebody might not really want to be traced through creating a larger database of election violence or sexual violence, they are putting themselves on the map as a way to create a larger project and document what's going on in their community. So as much as these are transformative, that's one type of volunteer geographic information, and the other pertains to citizen science. Does anyone know what citizen science is? So there's a couple different types that basically leverage this volunteered content, and it's very well established in certain fields. So the United States Space Agency, so NASA, utilized volunteers to help classify craters in the surface of the moon. And so anybody in this room can act as a citizen scientist. Go online, you can classify the size, the scope, you can measure different parts of the crater and create information that goes into a larger data set and helps NASA do their science. And they actually have figured out through this project that many contributors, everyone in this room measures the same crater. If we take an average of what everybody came up with, that average is roughly equivalent to someone who had years and years and years of geologic training to classify craters. So we end up with this very accurate data source that can really help promote science without contributing any money. We've basically crowdsourced science. And this has a large impact as far as using a general audience to provide information rather than a very skilled data set. So the same thing, the Audubon Society does this as well with their Christmas bird count. Has anyone heard of that or participated in that? So a couple of you have, where you as citizens are going out and counting how many birds do you see, and people are doing it all over the world at the same time and creating this very large data set that contributes a larger source of knowledge when it's aggregated together. So but even though we have all these claims about opening up participation through crowdsourced data and creating these larger forms of science through this, the participation of who's contributing this data really varies dramatically by income, age, race, demographic positioning, class, all of these different categories. So really, the people who are contributing citizen science and who are contributing user-generated content to OpenStreetMap, to Ushahidi, to Wikipedia are a very small class and segment of society. And it's a very small proportion that really doesn't vary much demographically. So it's really crucial to remain mindful as to who is the potential source of this crowdsourced information. Even though it might draw on thousands and thousands and thousands of reports of people about really unprecedented topics, including marijuana, it's really important to keep in mind that it is very limited as far as how much of a demographic variety it can achieve. So in the case of marijuana and other legal drug economies, most of the available data in the United States, as I mentioned before, derives from these local and federal law enforcement agencies, particularly the United States Department of Justice. And they're really charged with combating trade. So you have to kind of question the result of the data that they produce and that they distribute. And this, what their data really represents is these moments at which the underground economy really intersects with law enforcement. And that's not necessarily always accurate as far as it's defined in terms of arrests, eradication of plants and facilities. And very little data actually occurs or is recorded and documented about the mundane operations of the marijuana economy in any sort of systematic manner. It's really just these extreme cases of arrests and such. So, well, there's several different pro-marijuana sites that are used as far as consumers go that include suggestions of where to buy marijuana, potentially. The rest of this talk will really focus on this one site called priceofweed.com, which is very user-friendly as far as its implication that makes sharing and searching for retail pricing of marijuana very easy. And they're very explicit about how they're collecting data and how anonymous it is. You'll notice this is part of their homepage, where they take and automatically fill in your location based on your IP address. They are not tracking your IP address. They're suggesting it, and you can change it, and you're supposed to report the last place where you bought marijuana. And so you'd enter, I'm in the United States, California, Eureka, I paid so many dollars for an ounce of whatever medium quality. The select strain is new. This wasn't there a couple years ago. And you might, I guess you could put up a picture. We didn't harvest that data. And then you post it. And they're very clear about the anonymity of the data. And they're also very clear that the reason why you should do this is you want to know what marijuana is really worth. The entire purpose of this site is that, as they say, we want to crowdsource the street value of marijuana from the most accurate source possible, you, the consumer. And so they want you to help by anonymously submitting data on the latest transaction you've made. But as you might notice, this creates a large data set of anonymously submitted reports of marijuana pricing, which for us is very interesting as researchers to study. And they also ask users to rate how their perceived strength of law enforcement and how heavily enforced marijuana is within their local community, within the same geographic bounds that they've submitted the price for. And they also ask for users to submit their social acceptance of data. So how socially accepted is data within your community, or is marijuana within your community? And you can indicate, yes, I think it's very acceptable, and no, it's not very acceptable. And this varies over geography as well. And then from that, they're very open about sharing the data that is collected through this project, as it is really a citizen science project. It's very much crowdsourced. And telling users, well, this is what it averages out to in the state of California or in your local geography. So, for this study, the data that I obtained included 22,365 reports of marijuana collected between September 2010 and March 2011. And the guy who runs the site is a nice man in Toronto, and actually he was very willing to share his data and just send an Excel file with all of these 22,000 reports. And of those, we were able to analyze them and say 76.3% are from the United States, another 10% are from Canada. And there are only 12,873 user-generated reports of law enforcement and social acceptance. And those we can link by geography and timestamp, but actually there is no other ID or any other field where we could link those two forms and get an estimate of how much price is based on the law enforcement rating. So we just have to make an assumption based on the geographic area at the aggregate. So this is the data I was able to get from it, is their ID, their country, their region, the city, the time and date of they submitted it, the price in U.S. dollars, the amount, which is the quantity that they did, and the quality, as well as the price, of course, and law enforcement and social acceptance were all I was able to get, which is a huge amount of data, actually. So from the United States, we're looking at 17,000 54 records. Then they took a whole process of cleaning the data to use it as well. So everybody submitted, sometimes in grams, sometimes in ounces, it just took a bit of conversion to get that to be equivalent on all fronts. So once it was all the same unit of measurement, then we were able to analyze it. But to clean it, you'd be surprised how many people entered, "I paid zero for marijuana," in which case we just deleted all records of prices that paid less than $20 per ounce, as that was unreasonably low, and ones that were over $800 per ounce, as that was unreasonably high. So the mean in the end was $317 per ounce, and all records that were more than two standard deviations above or below that were removed from the record. So in the end, it ended up being a point file of 16,502 records, which is still a massive amount, and still any larger than any other study on the economies of marijuana that's ever been conducted. And it's associated with 2,397 unique locations in the United States. And that also included Puerto Rico and Hawaii, which were later removed from the study as well. And so the next thing that people had submitted ratings of was, what is the quality of that marijuana? And you'll notice from the chart behind me that actually there were almost 10,000 people saying high, which was 60% had submitted high quality ratings, 23% submitted medium quality ratings, and only 8% submitted low quality ratings, which actually does impact the geography of marijuana when you consider that a lot of the lower quality ones might be suffering from border effects of marijuana coming into the country from Mexico. Just to give a standard for quality, as different qualities we assume have different prices, we went with just the high quality ratings as well for this. And so just staying with the 9,955, these were pretty well distributed throughout the United States. And I'll give you more example of that in a second. But when we were limiting to this, and here you can see that larger cities, of course, had many more price reports submitted about them. Smaller cities, rural towns, had very few quality reports submitted about them. So when you aggregate it at the state level, you can start to see that there's substantial geographic variation in the price reports within the United States, with generally lower prices in the West Coast and generally much higher prices in the Northeast and South. So the average state price for high-quality marijuana indicates that Oregon has the lowest price at $256 per ounce, and Delaware has the highest price with $450 per ounce for marijuana. These prices are consistent with 20% lower than the average price of $16 per gram in 2007, which is what the federal government had estimated. So limiting the price differential to the state level doesn't really take advantage of the diversity of this data set, as we have it at a much finer geographic scale. So I also estimated it at the city level and used crowdsourcing again in the number of reports that people submitted as a way to estimate the accuracy of the surface. So the mean price for all user reports from a particular city can serve to reduce the variance. So this is when I just looked at all cities that have more than two or more prices reported. And you can see that there's a very high amount in very splotty large cities in the U.S. as well as the upper Midwest. And when you get to 10 records, it smooths out a little more, as far as you can see that the upper Midwest is still very high, but it just estimates over. It creates a smoother model over smaller cities, as larger cities in this point can determine the price structure for large areas geographically. And then with 20, you get to 20 records, you just see these very strong regional variations of the Northeast being very high, and the upper Midwest being high, and the very far Southeast being high. and this high in price. I don't mean anything relating to marijuana otherwise. And once you get over 30 records, this pattern stays the same, and it's quite consistent as well. So this uses a statistical interpolation technique called kriging, which is identified as the variance among price differences at the local level, in this case through a spherical semivariogram model. This is calculated based on the average variance for all point pairs in 3,000-meter intervals through the entire country. So this is just interpolating, again, and weighting the prices by how much the prices of their neighbor, what the average price of the neighboring cities were. So just to model it, I just ran a really standard regression model. Well, cartographic analysis provides very useful at looking at it geographically, and you can see these nuanced visualizations within the data showing these price differences. You don't really see what factors are driving it. So this is to help us understand, by running a regression analysis, the statistical test to see the direction of the relationship between the retail price of marijuana and very much other factors. So given the nature of the underground economy, there are few direct measures of these factors available, so I had to run this model at the state level instead of the city level. Nevertheless, there are many meaningful proxies that we can use to really understand what explains the causal relationship behind differences in the retail price for marijuana in the United States. So just to go through this, the dependent variable in this model is price, which is the price per ounce coming from priceofweed.com. The rank in plant eradication, this is because California accounts for 70% of eradicated plants, as I think previous speaker in the series mentioned. So going with a ranking actually allows the model to not consider the difference between California and the next highest state. This just lets us see the difference between the 50 states. Instead of quite as much of the enforcement measure behind that. The other things I looked at were percentage of youth, which is the percent of people between 15 to 24, the marijuana possession arrests per capita for each state, which is collected federally, actually. Price of weed reports per capita, so how many price of weed reports were there per capita in that state, so how much are people reporting, how much they bought marijuana for. Another interesting factor was using the distance to Humboldt County, California, which is just the average great circle distance to the centroid of Humboldt County. And this gives an idea of perhaps the transportation effects of marijuana being produced in Humboldt County and how that plays out over the national scale of pricing. Then I looked at marijuana sales arrests per capita, so how many people were arrested for selling marijuana. The social acceptance measure that people had crowdsourced on priceofweed.com for that city, saying marijuana is much more accepted in my community or not accepted in my community. Law enforcement measures, same thing. The law is harsh on marijuana. The law is easy on marijuana in my state. And finally, the medical marijuana per state. And this was, again, between... this is as of March 2011, because this data was collected from 2010 to 2011. So at the time, there were only 16 states that had medical marijuana programs. And, of course, running the model, we were able to determine that very significant factors include the rank in plant eradication was very positively associated, so the more plants that are eradicated, the higher the prices, which gives a little bit of an idea of the supply impacting the price. The number of price of weed reports per capita has a negative one, so the more people that report how much they paid for marijuana, the lower the price is likely to be. And this can factor into many different things, including the social acceptance factor, again, of you're not likely to report how much you paid for marijuana unless you feel some level of comfort with buying marijuana. And then a positively correlated is the miles to Humboldt County. So as you get, as in the United States, as you get further away from Humboldt County, the price of marijuana increases. So Humboldt County and the distance and proximity to Humboldt County lowers the lowers the price that you were likely to pay for marijuana. And this, again, is a transportation effect. If Humboldt County is a large producer of marijuana in the United States, it's very plausible and it's unsurprising that proximity to Humboldt County determines the price. Negatively affecting it, of course, is medical marijuana in the states. And this is actually one of the strongest variables driving this model, is that if there's a medical marijuana program, again, this is a binary variable, if you have that medical marijuana program, the price is likely to be lower, significantly lower. And this means that actually it's kind of much more interesting, as it implies that medical marijuana programs are pulling the demand away from the illegal drug market. So that's one of the more interesting findings of the study. Turns out less than 95% significant, so they might be a little bit, but not significant enough, are the percentage of people between 15 and 24. So young people are not a driving factor of marijuana pricing. Possession arrests per capita and sales arrests per capita actually had almost no effect on the price. So those levels of enforcement and measurement did not impact how much marijuana is likely to cost. The social acceptance and the perception of law enforcement were surprisingly unrelated to the price of marijuana. So conclusions. Basically, a detailed analysis of the retail geographies of marijuana and a demonstration that despite the limitations of volunteer geographic information in academic research, data collected in this sort of decentralized manner by citizen science scientists contributing how much they paid for marijuana can nonetheless allow for an unprecedented insights into the aspects of the economy that would otherwise be unmeasurable. A related observation is that the 16 states that allow medical marijuana have lower prices than those do not. So this indicates that by allowing it to be sold legally, states have shifted demand out of the underground economy. Pretty much unsurprising in that case. Again, arrests and criminal enforcement of marijuana does not impact the user-reported prices that are occurring within the economy. Eradication measures, however, do increase the price at the state level. So states with medical marijuana, as I said, have lower prices, and this does have a lot of implications for studying other illegal activities using crowdsourced data. We could study hacking, piracy, and perhaps even illegal labor practices through this. Again, as I said about Ushahidi, which has been used for a variety of different ways of monitoring violence, could also be used similarly as a platform to look at perhaps other illegal economies or underground activities. But this does, however, raise a lot of questions about privacy, about whose data are you taking, do you have their permission to use it, and what potential impacts could it have on the person who's contributing that information. So that's all I have for you today. If you have questions, you can email me. You can also check out the blog on the side there. This is the map that ended up in Wired magazine based on this study. And again, the study is coming out in Economic Geography sometime in 2013, as soon as I finish it. So I'm happy, we've got a little bit of time. I'm happy to take some questions. Yeah.
Did you consider for the states that had legalization programs to go to the dispensaries or whatever they were and to find out what they were charging the prices and to chart those or to look into those? That would seem to be a very reliable source of data as a comment, because dispensaries often price their marijuana accordingly to their local market.
So at the time we started the study, we really thought that none of the dispensaries would be willing to talk to us. Turned out, by the time we finished the study, two or three dispensaries had contacted us and said, hey, I'm willing to share my data. But between that time period, you know, it's harder, and I don't know if it would necessarily, because it's only those 16 states, if it would make that much difference on the national or international price structures. But within those 16 states, it's a really interesting question, and there are all those students here who are interested in doing research on marijuana. It's a very productive avenue of research to do. So, thanks.
You said that eradication practices are a significant variable on the price, that brings the price up.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't California, you said that 70% of all the eradication is in California, so wouldn't we have the highest prices in the country?
Right. So again, it's an ordinal rank. So it just, California is number one, and then you have number two and three and four, and like the other states, Kentucky is one of the higher ones as well, and Kentucky has a much higher pricing despite having lower levels of production, but still very high. Again, because it's a rank instead of a raw number, it doesn't factor in exactly the same way.
So basically you're just kind of throwing it out because California is such an exception to all the other states, because we grow most of it and we have all the eradication.
Right, you grow a lot of it, and so when it's normalized, it would create a very weird variable, but again, by using rank as a way of using it, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, instead of 1 million plants, 500,000 plants, and 1,000 plants eradicated, rather than using the number of plants eradicated or the percentage eradicated, the rank is in a way to consider California's substantial impact on it. Roland.
I was surprised that there was no correlation of the percentage of 15 to 24-year-olds with the price. Does that mean 15 to 24-year-olds have a lot more money than we think?
I think it's that there are a lot of 15 to 24-year-olds everywhere. And I think that there are some 15 to 24-year-olds that smoke marijuana and buy marijuana and report prices of marijuana. And there are others that don't, but just the number of them isn't a driving force for price. One interesting factor that a reviewer on the paper brought up and is going to be incorporated into this model is the impact of race. And are certain races predisposed to paying higher prices in marijuana? Which is a really interesting question that the next revision of the paper will be addressing.
Do you have data on the ages of the users?
So this isn't looking at the users. This is looking at who submitted price reports. And we don't have data on the ages of those individuals who submitted the price reports. We just have the information that they submitted through price of marijuana. The information that we do have comes from arrests. And again, this higher level, this top-down distribution of information that I'm trying to get away from a little bit in doing this study.
Just kind of follow up on the first question. Apparently, medical dispensaries were included in this analysis.
So yeah, their data was reported. And again, that is likely something that lowers prices, I'm guessing, in some places. And I don't know exactly. They're likely charging less at a dispensary than some of the street prices.
Right. But that isn't really part of the underground.
Exactly. It's not, but we can't figure out through what people submitted which variables are ones that people bought at a dispensary and are like, I'm going to report what I paid at the dispensary for marijuana versus I paid what I'm going to, or I'm reporting what I paid on the street. There's no way to separate those two sets of data. So,
do you have any idea what the breakdown is percentage-wise?
No idea what the breakdown is percentage-wise, but we can say that there are only 16 states where people could possibly have submitted what they paid for it at the dispensary. So we can look at those 16 states and how they're different, and we can say that, yes, within those states, people generally put lower prices, and hence that was a factor in the model that lowered the amount of pricing.
And those 16 states may have contributed a large proportion of the total.
I don't think they did. Well, we can look back at that, the records. I mean, California produced a lot of the data, but most of the data was based on population. So California produced a lot. New York produced a lot. Massachusetts produced a lot. If you just think about how the population breaks down in the United States, that's where we had the most reports. I mean, it's similar to how the Electoral College breaks down to how lots of things that are driven on population are divided. So. I have no idea because prohibition was much bigger thing before the internet.
So the data is very internet dependent.
Well, yeah, I'm using crowdsourced data that comes from a website. So, you know, I don't think we had websites during prohibition.
I just thought somebody might have been curious.
It's very possible that there was a study. I mean, there have been other studies looking at pricing structures of marijuana. There was one that was not using the internet, but using a large survey of people to look at the regional variation within Australia. But there hasn't been much in the United States as far as that goes. And largely, I think, because marijuana is a controversial subject here more than in other places, perhaps. Danielle.
Correct me if I'm wrong, is Portugal legalize all drugs?
Decriminalize
them. Now, does that have, like, I don't know if you guys got any information from Portugal, but does that make a difference about price, decriminalizing? And
so it's doubtful that it does in the United States, but we do have the records for the international. So if that's something that you want to take a look at as part of your research project, I can give you that data. I can give you the whole data set as well. But especially if you want to take a look at how does it impact national laws outside of the United States, you could do a similar study in Europe. Sure. So this map is actually the same semi-variogram model of marijuana based on all cities that had two or more reports of marijuana in it. This was driven by the graphic editors at Wired Magazine that indicated yellow is most expensive and green is lowest pricing. And then the red pluses indicate all the different state laws.
Has there been any thought to study the time series?
Yeah, actually, there has been. And the thing is, at the time we did the study, price of weed had only been out for about 8 months. But now it's been almost 3 years, so doing another study would be much more interesting to look at. Has it gone down? How did the change of laws in several different states impact the pricing structure? That's a really interesting study that hopefully will happen, and maybe can somebody in this institute can do, or any of the students here could do. So, yeah, last question. This is this guy.
Okay. So when you converted all of your units into ounces, uh-huh. how did you deal with the fact that there tends to be a markup as units?
Yeah, so being very aware of this and explaining it out in footnotes in the paper didn't account for it. Because basically we can't know exactly how much they are accounting for the scale. We can just say, yes, there is a scale issue. We can assume that that happens everywhere. Again, why places that had only one report are not very accurate, because that one report could be someone buying just 1/8 of an ounce, and that they might be paying more than somewhere else where somebody bought one full ounce. Yeah, that's more reason why we can have this redundant coding, which is, in this case, there's something called Linus law, which is used by chemistry, physics, disciplines to say as much as you get the same reaction that happens several times, you can assume it's much more accurate when that happens. So. I think that's it for questions.
May I ask questions?
Okay, yes, Josh. Okay, Josh, you get the very last question.
Oh, he's got one over
okay,
there.
Okay, all right. So, over here. Last question.
I was wondering if your model tested for interactions between variables at all.
Yes, and the very first model, part of the reason it was kicked out was that, well, part of the, one of the comments the reviewers commented on heavily was the multicollinearity that happens when you aggregate to the state level and you're analyzing at the state level. So the revisions are considering both at the city level, which as well as at the state level, because the problem that when you do at the city level is your variables, you have every price point within the state has the same legalization variables and the same issues with medical marijuana and the same rankings. So you have all of this which interacts very heavily within it. But that was one of the problems with running it just as a straight-up multiple regression. Instead, we need to run it a little more carefully. So,
could you say who funded it, funded the research?
The New Mappings Collaboratory at the University of Kentucky. Nobody really funded it. I was a grad student, and the other two guys on the project were both professors, one at Kentucky, one at Oxford. But because the Price of Weed website is how we collected the data, the only resource that we needed was our desktop computers to analyze it. And actually, most of this was done with open source software as well. So. So as I said before, there's a lot of limitations with using volunteer geographic information. And while we have 20,000 reports of data, you can say it's a very small demographic segment that is reporting data, and that is an issue with it. And we can look at aggregates of income and age as a way to get around it, but it is not playing into it as far as the model goes, because we can't even determine the gender or age or class or race of any of our subjects in this research study. So there is definitely bias in it that we're not accounting for. So I think that's it. That's the last question. But you can always email me or contact me with questions. But that's it. Okay. Sorry, Josh. You can ask me. Did you have something to say? Okay. I don't know if you had another announcement about the next talk.
No, it was a question.
Okay. But there is